We're all misfits.
All right, you ragtag bunch of misfits.
You're a scrappy little misfit, just like me.
Biggest bunch of misfits I've ever set eyes on.
Good morning, misfits. You are tuning into another episode of the Misfit Podcast. Full Goon Squad back in the house.
Yo.
Congratulations to the Kansas City Chiefs on winning the Super Bowl. We recorded
Taylor.
6 days before, 5 days before the Super Bowl. So we'll see how that ages.
Pretty good.
On today's episode, we're going to dig into some of your questions. I got a DM on Discord that I thought was a really good thought exercise for everybody to kind of go through, because it is a question specific to a person that could have different answers for a lot of the people that listen to the podcast. So I thought it would be cool to go through that. We're going to check in with Sherb on how his seventh gear rowing went. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the other bitch work pieces. No. Bury the lead. Don't tell him. It went great. Couple other bitch work pieces to give context here. As always, the best way to support this show is to head to the following links and use our codes. SharpentheAxeCo.com. Use your favorite athlete code. You see, save 10%. They get 10% back to them. Properfuel.co. Use the code word misfit. MisfitAthletics.com. Get signed up for your individual programming needs. TeamMisfit.com for your affiliate programming needs. Before we get into your questions and Sherb's Suckfest.
That's hot. This podcast took a turn.
Yeah,
it sure did. Well, I got more left turns. Hold on.
All right. Life chat. What's up, gentlemen? What's going on? What do we got?
Question for the group.
Ooh.
All right. What Prompt feels me, better? Daddy. Oh, a really good piss or a really good dump? Which one's better?
A dump.
I'm curious what you guys
for sure a dump.
What do you guys pick? What's your pick?
Dump.
Really, like you really have to piss or you have to shit. Which one feels better? A good piss or a good dump?
Gotta be a shit.
Definitely.
You say what feels better?
Yeah, it's what's I guess subjective, right? You can decide what I mean by that.
No, but I think a real nice piss when you're in deep trouble is great.
Same one.
I had. Undiagnosed celiac disease for a long time. A shit when you have to shit is more of a relief to me than it is feels good. It's more like, thank goodness I made it to this toilet.
Thank goodness I was sitting instead of standing for this one.
Yeah. Yes. So I can get down with the idea of just
I'm on team
a nice,
piss.
A nice, yeah, I'm team piss for sure. A nice shit is can be okay, but I've got too many wars. It's going to be a long time. I need to go the
That's
25
plot,
years
itself.
That I went. Yeah. So when I'm 50, I can re-answer that question.
A tale of epic dumps.
You don't even want to fucking know.
I know we don't all
it's
have
like a children's book.
We don't all have digestive issues, but I feel like I think
we all do. Except
three of the four of us do.
I'm much more frequently. Do I have an occasion where it's like, oh, I have an emergency dump, I gotta go, than I have an emergency piss. Maybe it's because I dump so frequently that I'm just pissing every time, so I just take a no.
You don't
piss
feel like Tom Hanks in Green Mile? You're just out in the fucking
Ted
front yard.
Takes a piss.
The best time.
Ted never pisses without also shitting.
Yeah, I also that. Never shit without pissing.
Fuck, it's so good.
I hate this conversation.
Sorry, is that what you wanted for life chat? There you go.
Goodness.
Really, that was a good question.
Wowee. All
right, life chat. I'd say...
No, fuck off, Sherb. You're done for the week.
My God, I'm leaving.
You're in timeout. Enjoy your podcast. 3 minutes. Go to the penalty box. We'll come back around to you.
All right. I got one.
People wanted to know.
I did something that I never thought I would do, and that is create a note.
Drag. Smile?
I was going to say the exact same thing. What did you do?
I created a note that is titled Podcast Life Chat.
Whoa.
So that I don't get caught off guard by Life Chat once a week, even though
goodness.
I know it's going to come and I know that it starts.
What kind of mood are you in when you write these?
Does it just say golf? Golf.
Don't worry about
golf.
It.
Don't forget to talk about golf. Tuesday mornings.
No. Tuesday morning golf.
Remind
chat.
Me, Siri.
We're out of season. We're out of season. I mean, come March or April, maybe it'll change. How many, Drew, I think, I don't know if you do. Do any of you do coffee subscriptions?
Too poor.
Nay.
I did for a very long time and got into a fight with customer service and the owners of the company are married, and the husband emailed me back trying to get me back as a customer, like begging me to come back as a customer. Because I just sort of was like, hey, like as a small business owner, this might be the worst customer service I've ever received. Basically, they sent me a really bad coffee. And it was like, you could tell in the like notes of it that it essentially said it tasted rotten and some people like it. And I was like, I don't know if you should send that out to that many people. That
was one of the,
it smelled like garbage when you brewed it. It was really bad. Ooh. And she was just like, basically like hipster talked me like, you don't know, like you don't understand the art.
And I was like, okay, loser. Sick. You wouldn't get it.
I'll cancel my
subscription. I understand shit.
And then now I do the Cometeer pods. So like kind of. Sort of. They're really good and way overpriced, but
way
really good.
Overpriced.
Yeah, the price is
pretty
crazy.
I've done Trade. This is not an ad. This is not a paid ad. Although if you work
for sponsored?
If you work for Trade and want this to be a paid ad, that can
Hunter
be
comes in XJ four star dash for 1% off.
Yeah, so I've been and I what I do, so I get 110. Get the new coffee and it's
is
on
this,
like a
hold on, sorry, pause. Is this is this the brand of coffee, or is this
Trade is the company. Trade is the company.
And they send different brands.
Like, yeah, they just send you. Oh, nice, you basically good. Fill out your profile. You
Folgers.
Say like what you like, whether it's like
charcoal
like,
roast,
type of roast. Do you want it like whole bean or ground, whatever? And then they send you a new one at like your preferred rotation. And I basically figure like it ends up being after like it's basically like $20 a bag delivered. And if you go to Whole Foods, like, and they're shopping for, I would say, like, above average coffee, you're going to pay, like, $18 a bag, sometimes, like, $22 or $23 for a 12-ounce bag. So I was like, okay.
Are they 12-ounce bags they're sending you or 1 pound?
12-ounce for the most, I think, exclusively 12-ounce. But basically in line with what you get it, like, would get at a Whole Foods or something like that, and good quality. And basically what I do is I take a picture of all of the coffees that I like, and
oh man, you're up my fucking alley right now.
Yeah, basically I take a picture of the bag, and I'm like, oh, I like that bag, so I just take a picture in case, you know, I want to like slip it back into the queue for the next delivery.
What's your preferred roast?
Light.
Yeah, same.
Yeah,
same.
Light roast. Light roast. Whole bean. I am a. I like the fruity or chocolate notes. Like,
do you actually catch? Do you catch those notes when you're tasting it? Or are you like, there's the blueberry chocolate?
I try to. You can. I feel like I can smell them more, like in the bag. Like once I open the bag, the first kind of like whiff or like pressing through like the one way like air thing on the bag, you can very subtly pick them out. I'm getting better at it, but I'm certainly no like someone like smelling whiskey and being like, ah, yes, that's
smoky
alcohol.
Afterbirth.
That chestnuts. I smell that smells like
from Alberta.
These nuts. Yeah. So, but yeah, so that's coffee chat. Most recent bag is Necessary Coffee. And
okay.
that is an approved bag. Photo has been taken. That is in the rotation.
Notice the difference? Do they send you washed versus natural process? Do you get both?
I think I get both, but I don't know, to be honest, enough. You've told me it once or twice before, and I've forgotten.
Natural
it
process
once
is
or
funky.
Twice.
It is really funky.
I like it.
Like you, really? It is very different. Yeah. Yeah. I actually think I remember when we were buying some different stuff for a while, one of the natural process ones, Sherbin Ted really liked. And I just like, I liked it hot, but if I like let it cool down basically to the point where you could like really taste it, I couldn't get into it. Some of the blends that I get sent to me are decent because you get like a little bit of that, but it's not overpowering. But the natural process, I just... Oof, it's got a real funk to it. Because I thought for a while that a lot of the Ethiopian coffees I didn't like, but I like the Ethiopian when they're washed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a... I have noticed that because the Ethiopian coffees are very hit or miss for me personally.
Yes. Actually, yeah, and I actually found that it was washed versus natural. That made a huge difference for me. I don't know that it's actually mutually exclusive, like... binary, like I either like it or I don't, but more often than not, if I get sent a natural process, I'm just like, I don't know that I can do a whole bag of this, like,
yeah,
every
the last
day go through
the
it.
Last bag I took a picture of is Broadsheet Coffee Roasters, and that is washed process. That's a Rwandan. That was a Rwandan coffee. Nice. But yeah, and then one of my remote athletes, shout out Joe Bel Bruno, he actually roasts his own coffee beans.
Really?
Sent me a bag. The beans are from, they're Yemenis. And his note, he sent a bag and a little note. The note was just like, this is like, basically like, this is hit or miss for some people. Like, it's an acquired taste. It tasted pretty good, but I can tell there's definitely a little different. I don't know what the,
whether what's your brew method?
The washing process. French press for the most part.
Yeah.
I need
Mr. Coffee.
It's either French press or like a standard drip coffee. I need to get a pour over, more of a spatial consideration for me right now versus a
AeroPress is a really good in between. That was the first one that I did where I could like felt like I could really dial in. Like I kind of moved on from there. Just because
isn't AeroPress like for espresso?
No.
Am I thinking of something different?
I don't think you're necessarily thinking of something different. I know that some people use different quantities of coffee to water ratio.
That's the giant fucking tube.
It's not giant.
Yeah, it's pretty small. It's pretty small because it collapses into itself. So it's maybe 5 inches tall, something like that, when it's collapsed down. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we need to talk about your brew method, but we'll get there. What you got, Ted?
One step at a time. 38 is old. I feel old as fuck these days.
Dang.
Yar. So I've been
oldest
going
guy on the podcast.
I've been going so back old. To jiu-jitsu.
So much older than me.
And every time I go, I feel like I find something new that fucking hurts. I've got like thumb things, neck things, my knee. Like I just, you know, we played football for years. So like I understand sports injuries versus like, oh, this just kind of got tweaked and it feels a little funky. And I feel like every move that I make at the gym results in some kind of tweak of some kind of
some
thing.
Kind of injury.
yeah.
So if right now is zero and jiu-jitsu is 100, how much time throughout the day do you spend between zero and 100? It's like, I know you like go for a walk, like you walk the dog pretty regularly.
Yeah, I probably walk like 3 or 4 miles a day with the dog.
Yeah.
So that's like
that's one thing
day.
Your body's like, hey, what are we doing?
Well, yeah, there's that. Hunter wrote me a little activation that I've been doing before class for like, I don't know, 15 minutes, 10 minutes or something like that. So it's not zero directly to 100 necessarily, but it's like zero to 10, then to 100. I think is probably the steps there.
Yep. Yeah, I'm my thing now is I still feel pretty good if I work out after like warming up properly, and then the ramifications of that seem to be more of when I feel old. Like I went snowboarding yesterday and I woke up this morning and like my fucking adductors are getting me a little bit, and I'm just like, I didn't even do that many runs. Like I was, you know, with my niece most of the time. So I wasn't like flying around, but still woke up this morning and like made one move, like one of those weird, awkward moves when I was trying to sit up holding my kid and then go to standing. And I was like, oh, that's awkward.
Snowboarding when you haven't done it for a while does that too. Cause there's all the like little stabilizer shits that you never would have to use otherwise. Basically,
I only had one season in Colorado that was like I started when I was doing CrossFit. Like all of my other years were like just meathead shit, or I was doing boxing. And I had one year where I was doing like, because normally that first day, especially out there with how long the runs are, like maybe you get 10 in total, because you're just like your legs are fucking dying. And I remember going from like taking CrossFit class almost every day at an affiliate out there to snowboarding. And it was like such a fucking game changer. It was crazy how much different it was.
Yeah.
Like I was completely fine the whole day and all of my non CrossFit friends were fucking not happy with themselves.
See.
Yeah, I was going to say that I went snowboarding and then I just did. I take my brother, his wife and his daughter once a year kind of as like a Christmas gift. And I didn't have expectations last year, but I also did not know what I was getting myself into. We were, I think, over an hour on the first run. And then I don't know how many people that listen to this podcast have been to Sunday River, but you could maybe run up. You could definitely run up most of the peaks in an hour. So just to give reference of trying to slide down it on a snowboard for that taking that long. So then this year, I wasn't really sure how far we had progressed. And we actually like went snowboarding yesterday, which was nice. Sick. She was linking her turns down the hill. And I was like, okay, here we go.
Nice.
And sick. She likes to.
How hard is that? Linking turns. I have no fucking, I have no reference for how hard that is.
When you're new, it can be intimidating because going from your heel or from your toe side to your heel side, you're basically blind in that turn. So like, it gets a little bit intimidating at first.
It's honestly, it's like risk to reward is really big in it because basically what most beginners do is they do what you'd call the Christmas tree. They ride down their regular way on their heel edge, and then they rotate and ride down the opposite way on their heel edge, and they literally just ride down the mountain like this so they can face down.
Snowplow.
And like linking your turns, like you could get it done in like a day or two if you're willing to
eat shit,
smash your fucking tailbone and hit the back of your head, fall, like get like knock the wind out of yourself. And you do, like, if you do that enough times and the snow's not really great, it sucks. Like, it's not fun at all. Like, I've been with people before, but then again, like the third time that that kind of person goes, they can just ride down the mountain and start to learn. And I actually learned the second time that I'd sort of restarted doing it with a bunch of people that didn't know how to snowboard, and it sucked. And then I went with Ted, and he was like, hey, why don't you do this? And then I could snowboard. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like, it literally was just one person being like, no, I don't know what that is exactly that you're doing. But if you just do this with your back foot, then you can turn. And I was like, oh, wow, this is fun. So you kind of gotta, I don't know. Like, if you wanted to just go, I would recommend skiing. Like, even though that's like me recommending someone golf or listen to country music.
So lame. Like,
it's just it's just a lot easier to just strap those things on and ride down.
Sounds like more my speed. My experience with the snowboarding is the plastic one you can buy from Walmart. You slide your feet into.
Nice.
And cool borders on PlayStation 2.
Hell yeah.
That's my snowboarding experience.
What a fucking game. Yeah. Oh my God.
That game was so fun. There,
sure, but if you ever want to go, hit me up. We'll go. I'll make you turn.
Yeah, what does that mean?
You'll find out.
And my little HRV N=1 experiment just keeps, like, things are becoming more and more clear. Like, if I have a night where I am in charge of like doing the nighttime routine for my son and I don't eat before that, if I have to go down and cook after that, my HRV and sleep score are completely different. Like, eating from either like between 6 and 6:30 versus like 7 and 7:30, like, significant difference.
What time are you going to bed?
Like 9:30. He likes to wake up at 5:45 sometimes. So
I sleep so much fucking worse when I have to get home. When I get home at 8 p.m. from coaching the evening class, then make dinner, then start eating at 8:45, and then go to bed at 9:30. That's fucking
miserable. The Garmin gives you,
just stay up later.
Usually the highest correlation is your stress score on the Garmin, and it'll tell you your stress score on the nights where you don't get like the best sleep and your HRV is a little bit lower. And that's either like food, alcohol, like drinking way too much water right before you go to bed, so you're like peeing all night, like that kind of thing. So I don't know. I'm trying to remember who said this, and I don't love, like, I like, was it like a heuristic or something like that? I like the little sayings for you to remember. So it's the 3-2-1 rule. 3 hours before bed is when you should cut off your food. 2 hours is water. 1 hour is your phone or something like that. And I think that's like a little strict, but it's a pretty, honestly, a pretty good guideline. If I'm done eating by 6:30 and I go to bed at 9:30, my sleep is completely different. And like, the one weird thing about it is getting up, I know I already said this, but getting up at the exact same time every day or right around the same time, that also has made my HRV consistently higher. And it's just weird to think, like, I actually don't need, based on my activity levels, I don't need that extra sleep cycle. It's kind of odd to think about that, because I think what that does is that's setting me back however much level of activity I would get in that first hour of the day to sort of build up the, like, sleepiness chemicals that would then make me more tired later in the day.
I've been a little bit more consistent with my wake time, because previously I would naturally wake up at a certain time and just kind of go through my morning and then get to the gym at about the same time, whether I'm coaching in the morning or not. But just waking up, like, I've started setting an alarm. It's still close to, like, when I would normally wake up, which is around 6:30, but it's given me, like, a little bit more structure. Six, nice. A little more structure to my morning as far as, like wake up, get my, like, get coffee ready, meditate, 20 minutes of reading, and then I'm not rushed to, like, get through my kind of morning routine, and I can get to the gym, like, with plenty of time to be ready to coach or just kind of get into the workday. And I think that has been more, the routine is, at least for me, similar boat to you, like, more beneficial than, let's say, I want to wake up at 7 instead of 6:30. Like, because it's not going to be 6:30 or 8 a.m. Like, I'm not going to wake up at 8 a.m.
Right.
But that extra 30 minutes I'm finding is more beneficial as far as just, like, a circadian rhythm and getting, like, set for the day and being less stressed to, like, at least start my day. And if I start my day stressed, like, it'll probably carry through most of the day. It's hard to, like, come down, like, reverse reset. That if you start not so stressed, then the day is a lot more approachable.
I'm working on a little talk track right now for another, like, affiliate lecture, and I'm not sure whether, like, I know you guys would find this interesting and a lot of our listeners were, but there's definitely some, like, hey, science bitch, stop it. But basically what happens to the, like, byproducts of ATP as it's broken down, and then how that actually ends up making you tired. Because the, like, one of the things in my 99 and the one lecture is that was added as of the last year or two, especially because of my, like, marathon training, was the whole, like, are you tiring yourself out? Like, that is probably the number one fucking question. Like, why am I not tired? What would make
Fuck did you do?
What would make someone tired, right? Like, and then
you mean, are you tired to go to bed?
Like, sure, yeah. Like people are like, yeah. I lay down and I'm not fucking bad tired. Sleeper. So why would I go to bed? Yeah. And then it's like, okay, are we walking at all? Are we doing anything outside of coming to class? And it's really cool that essentially the breakdown of our like, I don't know, our little energy blocks ends up telling our bodies that we're tired and causes us to be sleepy and go to sleep. But again, what is, you know, do I write ATP? Is it like adenosine? Are we talking about that? Am I writing that on the board? Or am I like, you get like Pac-Man.
Energy points.
Yeah, you get little energy bars like Pac-Man, and then they break up into pieces, and some of those pieces are tired pieces. Anyways.
Ooh, tired pieces. Reese's pieces.
Yeah, Reese's pieces. All right.
Wow, man.
Discord DM. Really good question. Good context. When looking at the day's work, I can get all of the mandatory stuff in, but struggle to decide on the gears work, just referencing bitch work, monostructural work, or another Metcon. I'm a solid athlete looking to make the Masters Games this year. Last year, I was 45th in the world. I tend to struggle on longer Metcons with holding pacing. I've focused on this a lot, but not sure what to add in to help. I feel the Metcons for practice would be help. I math twice a week. I swim once a week. I tend to get four pieces in a day, strength, Metcon skill, and either accessory work or Metcon 2. The reason I thought that this was a very interesting question is because I think there is a list of reasons why someone wouldn't be good at longer Metcons, in quotes, that we could dig into. There'd be different reasons why that would be happening. And I think it'd be cool to essentially go around and make that list and then talk through what it would take to improve on those things. So I'll throw it to you guys first to just sort of top of mind, like what would cause someone to struggle in longer Metcons with holding pacing?
Athlete IQ is the first thing that jumps out at me, not knowing how to execute on said piece, not realizing that in one of those longer AMRAPs, there's probably a pace limiter, something you can kind of modulate up or down that has a dramatic effect on your ability to move through each of the other two or three stations that are in the workout. And do you understand your own physiology to know, like, all right, if it's 20 minute AMRAP, I'm not rowing at 1400. It needs to be 1100 so that I don't stand around at the wall ball, the toes to bar that follow. So the first thing I think of is just athlete IQ. And the hard thing I think for that athlete is early on, you might feel like you're going way too slow and that you're wasting a piece or wasting time, when in fact you're actually learning from said piece and you're constantly updating. Because we talk about this all the time with the affiliate. What's the point of being able to do 2 rounds in 2 minutes if the next 4 rounds take you 12? Like, it's just not the same pace, not the same workout. So learning what your sustainable pace is and experimenting with things that sometimes might feel too slow. Like, I think there's another thing athletes have in their mind is that, like, if I don't bury myself with every single piece, am I doing it right? And like, for a lot of athletes, you'd be better off going a little bit slower and learning about what your capacity is when you're consistent versus the yo-yo of up and down. I'm going hard, I'm going slow, I'm going hard, I'm going slow.
I think for the athlete who, a lot of times there's somebody who does, you do better with like, I'm going to come out at a pace that's a little bit faster and then settle in, or I'm going to kind of start at that cruising pace and try to hold it throughout. A strategy that you can employ is, I generally pretty much agree with everything Sherb said. The one strategy you can employ in those longer pieces is to come out at a slower pace than you think you should. And if worse comes to worse, in the last 5 minutes of, say, a 20-minute AMRAP, you're like, I've still got something in the tank, then like go faster. Like, the odds that you finish that workout and are like, wow, I wasted that entire 20 minutes is very low. And even if you do finish that 20-minute AMRAP and you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad, you now have like a baseline of like, well, that was doable. Like, I could do that workout at that pace. I think a better, maybe something more useful is that you need to try to, like, when it comes to a CrossFit Metcon, so a 20 minute AMRAP, and you compare that to, say, like a 5K row, which is roughly 20 minutes of effort, you have to get comfortable with translating effort on a machine where the machine is telling you exactly how fast you're going and whether or not you increase or decrease your pace. So you have the benefit of looking at the monitor that we talk about a lot of times, where you can see your pace, whether you're starting to slow down or speed up. What you have to do on those bitch work pieces is like really be in tune with how you're feeling, whether that means you're paying attention to your heart rate or just actually like in tune with your body itself, and then try to replicate that feeling within the Metcon. Because it's really difficult to do, you know, compare a 5K row to a 20-minute AMRAP of thrusters, burpees, and pull-ups. Like, those, you know, it's different enough that you don't have the monitor, you don't have kind of that heads-up display to tell you whether you're going too fast or you're settled in directly into the pace that you need to hold. A lot of it comes down to feel, and you have to get comfortable feeling, knowing where you're at in a workout, kind of thinking about checkpoints during a workout. One of the things that I like to tell affiliate athletes, especially in like a longer workout, and this works pretty well, if, let's say, again, take that 20-minute AMRAP, for example, if you're feeling real bad before the halfway point of that workout, you've probably gone too fast. If you're feeling real good 12 to 15 minutes into the 20-minute workout, you went too slow. The halfway kind of checkpoint, that check-in, is a really important place to kind of figure out whether or not you need to speed up, slow down, or if you're sitting at the right pace. So in addition to what Sherb said, I think just trying to translate feeling from bitch work pieces, whether that's an objective metric like a heart rate or just kind of the internal feeling of what's going on in your body, and then trying to translate that over to a Metcon is part of kind of that athlete IQ journey.
Another element that I would add to this is there's a few more, would be what I refer to as movement cost. So that splits out into two categories, but essentially if Hunter and Sherb are doing a workout, a longer workout that has, I don't know, chest to bar pull-ups in it or something like that, and one of them is moving very efficiently and one of them is not moving so efficiently, and is having to muscle their way through it, a lot of times two things can happen. One, obviously the movement cost is higher for the athlete who is putting significantly more effort into something that does not necessarily require that for another athlete. So there's an issue there. The other issue is the implication of mindset and feeling during those things, especially if you're acknowledging that it is a weakness. We really find that some athletes that don't like a certain movement, that haven't taken the time to improve it, end up not only having that high movement cost on like a physiological side, but also carry that baggage with them throughout a workout because it beats them down and then they get discouraged. And hopping onto a rower discouraged versus like, I'm a better rower than this person, I can catch them, are two different mindsets that you can have. So I think movement cost is really important because if we're talking about a 20-minute AMRAP, often that's a triplet. And if you can work through high rep of three separate movements at an efficient rate, you can essentially be less fit than another person and beat them, especially if you have the higher athlete IQ. The other part of this is Hunter referenced at 10 minutes, if this feels real bad, you've done something wrong. What does that mean? What does this feels real bad actually mean? Because I know some, I know some people that think that this feels bad means like I don't like this very much. And
this feels bad means I can't continue.
I know what you mean.
Okay. I thought you were asking. Yeah. I thought it was a literal question.
Well, it's a question to put out there of what is the expectation coming from you? What is your actual metric? Because every once in a while you will be served real bad by accident, and you'll be like, I don't know what the fuck that was. Like, that was very different. Like, on my list is talking about how we brought some Misfit Athletics flair to the Team Misfit programming this week, and there was people found out what real bad felt like at Misfit Gym Portland and Misfit Gym Wyndham this week with those sprintervals. We'll get there. So there is just that piece of you come in every day, everything is relatively uncomfortable that you're doing, and you start to water that down too much. And it's like at 5 minutes, it starts to hurt a little bit. And then at 10 minutes, it hurts a little bit more. And at 15 minutes, you're probably in kind of a rough spot. But if you've accepted that and you understand that you are capable of 5 more minutes of holding that pace that was feeling a little too easy for the first 5 minutes, then those things can change. And a lot of that is where the, you know, if you're watching on YouTube, this little guy over here, the suffer triangle, a lot of that's where that came from. What happens when shit hits the fan and I make a different choice about how I feel about that mentally? Because that really, you have power in that. Those moments when you're on the rower and you're doing 66 cal repeats and you realize that your pace isn't exactly what you wanted it to be. Is that panic time or is that like I slide into this and I get after it? And of course, there are instances where you just didn't pace properly. Like, I don't want to insinuate that that's a thing, but we find that especially at a very high level that athletes have, you know, they're uncomfortable, relatively uncomfortable, like 40 times a week. And it starts to, they get almost numb to it. And sometimes that can be a good thing because they can push really hard. Or sometimes it's like, oh, that's what I got. That's where I'm at. And that's when they come to a training camp weekend and find out once again what real bad is. And then they go back home and sort of reassess that thing. Last but not least here, obviously, is energy systems, right? I'm not good at long workouts. What are my energy systems like? When I, you know, basically we're looking at this, or I'm looking at this from four perspectives. You guys can chime in on how you feel about this, but I want to know what we're doing in send work. I want to know what we're doing in build work and aerobic work, and then the zone two stuff. So that's my spectrum where I'm looking at something and I'm like, okay, certain eggs in certain baskets. I will say that if you're only bad at longer Metcons and you're pretty good at short and medium, I really think it's probably a pacing thing. It's
you
can be really good at long Metcons, and then as you work your way down, you just don't have it yet in terms of strength or the anaerobic capacity. It's really hard to be good at short and medium and not long if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're 45th in the world, like, yeah, maybe compared to what your other like time domain workouts, you're not as good at that, but you're obviously not bad at long workouts. Like if anyone is good at medium length workouts,
they're good at everything else.
Right. If it's like, I can send it, got it. I can be an idiot when I need to be. Medium workouts, I can go to the Hurt Locker when I need to. If I'm bad at long workouts, especially with those other two boxes checked and we're doing the long stuff on the opposite end, to me, that's like, you just don't know how to do this workout correctly. Whether it's I don't know how to pace it correctly, I'm not taking the time to look at maybe the sets and reps and kind of it's like, oh, okay, so a round is going to take this long, and then if I multiply that out for 20 minutes, oh fuck, my math says I'm about to do 200 thrusters, 300 burpees, and 1,000 calories of rowing. So clearly my pace estimations are incorrect, and we can start to dial it in from there. And then it's like, okay, well, here's how many reps I'm going to do. Here's what that, okay, well, I have a comparison for that from a previous workout, and you can start to dial that in. So for me, for this specific listener, I have to assume this is a little bit lack of athlete IQ pacing sort of thing in those longer duration CrossFit specific, sport specific Metcons.
And it's gonna help you from a bunch of different perspectives if you just slow down like significantly the next time you do one of these and see what happens and build from there. Because the opposite is really hard to learn from. It is so hard to learn from like, I'm on pace for 10 rounds and I end up with 5 or 6. It's very hard to learn from that because, again, like movement cost comes into play even if you are a good mover. Like it's really hard to do some of the more dynamic things that you're asked to do when, you know, you're at 175 beats per minute and there's really nowhere to hide. So
it's funny too because it's kind of the opposite for like the affiliate. Sherb and I have talked about this a little bit before. It's like sometimes we find ourselves because the four of us are talking a lot of times to competitive CrossFitters who have experience in the sport and understand that if you go too hard early on, things will be bad. Like your score will be worse overall. And sometimes we take that all the way to the affiliate level where we have to remember that when we started CrossFit and really when anybody starts CrossFit, kind of part of the learning curve is, hey man, I need you to go way too fast. I know it. You don't. It's going to suck, but you're going to learn in that regard. Sometimes we go too far in the opposite direction where we tell, hey, the average person, hey, I want you to go slow at the start because I want you to, you know, because of pacing. And it's like, yep, that person's not here to learn how to pace CrossFit workouts. That person's here to get fit.
Dig like, a fucking hole.
Let them dig a hole, jump in it, and see what happens. And as we get more experience, that happens less and less. But it's kind of the opposite. Once you get past a certain point, we have to say like, okay, now you're trying to get, and again, for this person trying to qualify for the CrossFit Games, like, we now need the best score possible. And that requires a level of athlete IQ that might just be underdeveloped.
I'm gonna pause just for 1 second to start a fight between Hunter and Sherb. Do I have permission to publicly air how you felt about a recent workout that you beat Sherb in? Say yes.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. okay, I see where we're going with this.
Yeah. I believe the quote was, and this is for entertainment purposes only.
Yeah, sure. Educational. Entertainment.
I believe the quote was singles. At 155, what is this, 2007? I think you might have said.
This is fucking one rep max. How did I know he'd do touch and go threes?
Four. I could get this. Sherb,
3 weeks ago, Sherb touch and go squat snatched, what, 220? 220 for three? Is that what
it
you
was
hit?
A lifting session, not a Metcon guy.
You did. Oh, no, hold on, though. So the point here is this, because you, Sherb, you're in a weird spot. You in that workout were a midwit. You were too smart for your own good, which again is a tough balance between you're most of the time like affiliate guy, you want to take class, you want to coach, you want to teach, you want to be part of the community, but you still have some competitive aspirations. So you're trying to live in this moment of like, I want to like show the people out there how it's done, but also like you've had issues in the past with pacing. And I think you would admit based on the text you sent me separately that you did overpace.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely
did.
Yeah.
But yeah. My historically in a workout like that, I knew the time domain.
What was the workout?
The workout was 6 rounds, 3 snatches at 155, 10 calorie air bike, 3 wall walk complexes where you wall walk in and perform 1 wall facing handstand push-up, and then 10 more calories on the bike. So like based on quick math, we knew it was like a, on the fast end, like a 12 minute workout for like the absolute monsters out there. But for most people, it was probably closer to like a 15 to like, probably, I don't know, 15 to 18 minute workout, 18 minutes being a super long end.
3 minutes around.
Yeah. So the super long in there. So historically in a workout like that, I'm going to fucking shoot my shot. I'll hammer everybody into the ground in 2 rounds and then everybody will pass me at the end because I'm limping home. So in strategically try to be a bit more deliberate with the bike because, you know, when you hop on the air bike in the first round, you have done 3 snatches that take all of about 15 seconds and you're feeling fucking great. And if you go rip 500 watts, like you're going to be staring at the floor during your wall walk complexes. And then your next bike is sad and your snatches are sad. It just kind of compounds throughout the workout. So I said, I'm not going to fall into that trap.
That workout was so fucking hard, by the way. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
I said, I'm not going to fall in that trap. So I'm going to be a bit more deliberate. And, you know, I hit the first round. I'm like, all right, I'm holding about a 2.5 minute round. I can get a little faster as I go. I'll be somewhere in the 14s. And I was like 14:20. And then I, you know, felt pretty good about that. Execution was good. And then I, later on, I was like, oh, I'll just pop into the leaderboard for Portland.
Just to see
what everyone did. And it was like, all right, 13, 1250. I was like, God fucking damn it. And then I texted Hunter. I said, hey, next time we're doing this head to head. He's like, yeah, touch and go, pussy. He didn't say that, but like he basically said, I touch and goed. And I thought I made an error based on the fact that maybe I was supposed to do 12 calories. Like, no, you just play the workout better than I did.
Wait, we're supposed to do 12 calories?
No, Hunter thought that he made a mistake.
I did not look. I almost never look at the whiteboard or leaderboard before I do a workout. But I did it, logged my score, looked at the leaderboard, and I was like, those movements, the weight on the bar, basically I was like, there's no way I lose to Sherb or I beat Sherb in this workout. This is like all things that he's good at, except for maybe the stimulus, which is more in my wheelhouse than maybe it is his, kind of that cardio. Nothing's too muscular at any point, just more about breathing and transitions. And I was like, did I miss a round? Did I do something incorrect? And then we got to talking and like, I asked Sherb, I was like, he said he did singles. And I was like, was that intentional so that you could transition? Like, was there an athlete IQ thing here? And we came around, biked a little slower.
I mean, the size comparison, it makes sense that Hunter was going faster than you on the bike.
Truth.
Teehee. Okay, Sherb, you were going to say something? Do you remember?
Fuck, I forget. I don't know. I don't fucking remember.
Yeah, so the only thing that I will say here that can get a little bit misconstrued and can be a problem, especially if you are, he's putting in significant volume for a master's athlete for sure, which I believe is necessary for his goals. But I would really, in those situations, I like to take a look at any of the zone 2 work. And I'm wondering in a lot of cases about that, if it's actually like slow enough. I find that athletes that are putting in that level of volume that are potentially pushing a little bit too hard on some of the machines. And that's where like, each year we're personalizing how we ask for that a little bit more based on, I have to put, you know, you gotta put the saddle on some of these athletes like during the year for what they're doing. You know, I just give them a wattage in a lot of cases to make sure that they're truly, you know, below threshold.
I definitely think I am.
Yeah. I really would want to know where that's at. So that'd be another kind of nuance a little bit there, but I think it's a good segue into the gears chat because I think those things can be really useful just to audit what are my energy systems actually like? Like, is there just some place that you feel like is no man's land for you? And actually the funny thing is it doesn't always mean like I suck at seventh gear or second gear, or third gear, that you only do those things, because doing faster, you know, going above, going below, doing your math tone work, doing your send work, like those things will change stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, Sherb, you did the eight by 90 seconds with 4 minutes rest on the rower. You averaged a 139.
I make that up? Hold on. No, it's faster than that, but not crazy faster. Hold on. I'll pull it right up.
138?
I think it was 136.
It was 136.5.
Yeah, right. It is. I'm looking at it right now, bitch. 136.5.
Average
five.
Or your fastest one?
Average. Average.
All right.
Needless to say, I did not average that for my seventh gear rowing.
Right. So that was 5 by 66 calories, rest 3.5. I make that up? Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
And... I mean, I think someone who can hold what he did on the rower for eighth gear could still stay sub 140 for the whole thing.
Did not.
That did not happen. Spoiler. How did it go? And, you know, what do you think is your goal for the next time? What'd you learn from it?
Yeah, so I did round one, and it was a 139.8, and it was kind of a, I'm going to coast a little bit at the finish, so probably maybe a tenth or two faster for most of it, and just kind of settled at the very end there. And I said, fuck, I'm gonna really try like hell to hold 140 for the next one. And I didn't. I held a 140.1, and then the wheels fell off the bus. I don't know exactly if it were just too aggressive from the start. If I started like a 141 or a 142, I could have averaged it.
We did notice a 2 or 3 strokes per minute lower. I know that you said you played around with the damper a little bit. That can be
a little bit.
I find serious fluctuations in scores from athletes who aren't like kind of locked in on things like RPM, strokes per minute, damper, and whatnot. And obviously, rower to rower, it can be different with drag factor, but that's definitely something that like athletes should have a pretty good idea of where they want those things to be to repeat stuff.
And I put myself in a pretty big hole there. So like what we were talking about too afterwards is like, you know, round one at that pace, that's a 2 minute and 35 second row. My slowest was nearly, or was actually over 20 seconds slower, based on the fact that I was just not humming at the same output, and just as,
yeah,
that's purgatory for me. So like that is a very rough time domain, 2.5 minutes at that output.
So here's what's interesting. We have February 13th. So a couple days, or actually the day after this goes live, we have the next gear below, 4 rounds, row 900, rest 330. What do you believe your pace is for that workout based on this information? Because that's the one thing that I went in and looked at the other gears, and I still believed that in that neighborhood is the right call. As I started to go down, and I was like, he's pretty good at holding these like more middle gears for longer periods of time. Like, I think that's still like 142, 143 for you? Am I crazy?
Which one?
The 4
the
by
900s?
900, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to say I could say 145 or faster, but obviously this last performance doesn't give me the most confidence going into it, but
I think
doesn't
if
mean
you
I'm not going to try.
Back through enough workouts, you would find a workout where you went faster than 145 that is harder than this.
I think that was truly an anomaly in terms of pacing. I think I just maybe was at the, you know, the end of a three-day streak.
How did you sleep? What did you eat? What other volume did you have? You coming off a rest day? You going in? You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of factors, like, especially with, you know, how many plates you're spinning and what you're doing from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed. Like, it's not a perfect science for someone who's not, like, a professional CrossFitter.
And honestly, it's something like this. It's like, you know, I try to stick to a format of like 3 on, 1 off. I found that's working pretty well for me. And like, again, I don't remember off the top of my head. I can go back into my, you know,
sure,
I use Beyond the Whiteboard for my own personal like data tracking there. I could see if that was the third day in a row of training. Who knows what the fuck's been going on prior to, you know, sure. I'm like 10 years ago, like this didn't like ruin my day. I was just like, fuck,
bad day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I think there are two people who get wrapped up in the experience of like, fuck, I'm a complete failure. I better, you know, might as well sell my Romaleos and, you know, cancel my gym membership and never go back to the gym again. It's like, it's a fucking workout. Like, I got a good workout. It sucked balls. Like, I really wasn't happy with how I did in the moment, but I was just like, this is what you got. And it's better to do that and fucking go almost 6 seconds slower at the end than it is to do two rounds.
Stimulus.
And go, I suck and quit.
Think, yeah, think about like if you didn't get your screen and you just got your fucking Garmin data, how would you feel about that workout? You'd be like, hell yeah, I got to
I got to go work out. Yeah, I had a good time. Maybe it was one of those things where it's like, it fucking was hard and I got my, I got my 2 cents out of that.
We have all sat down on a machine with an idea of our pace and found out within round one or round two, you ain't doing that.
I knew after round one, I was
your body's not going to let you do that. That's one thing that I find so fascinating about the machines is like, there are days where it doesn't matter how hard you try. You can keep the right mindset and push. And it's like, no. You're not going to be able to do that. So we had I don't know what week it is in reality, whether it were in the future or the past.
October?
Or the present. It's Nudie Magazine Day. Eighth Gear running. You guys have some of your remote clients get into that this week. If you've gotten any reports back on it. So on the MFT end, it was 8x500. I believe it was 8x400 on Hatchet. And it's cool because you find, I think, doing really well in this is because of the volume of it, even though you do get a lot of rest, is a very good sign for like CrossFit, like your 7 minute workouts, your 12 minute workouts, your 16 minute workouts. Like, we're going to fall within, like, if we go into online competition, how many workouts fall into 0 to 15 minutes? Like, obviously that is most. A very large percentage of what we do. And it is a very good sign for, if we take that workout that you're trying to get better at and put it into a vacuum, into a bubble, like, this is the only thing that I have to do. And the open is one workout long and I get as much rest going into it and coming out of it and all that stuff. Obviously that's not how that works. But what would you say in terms of like giving someone advice on, they struggle with running or rowing or whatever in general, and then they come in and crush a workout like this, specifically, like, what can they do to sort of round that out, like get themselves to actually like get the rest of their energy systems in order? Because I just think the downstream implications of like how well you recover if you're the type of athlete that can go longer is a huge thing. Like, you might be able to do really well in this workout and then be in deep trouble afterwards because you don't flush waste all that well. You don't recover as easy as someone who has aerobic efficiency. And then obviously you guys know what happens when you do the long and boring work and then you end up in a workout that has like high rep front squats in it or something like that. And you're like, oh wow, like I can actually clear waste. I can continue to just show up at the bar, lift it, squat, all that stuff.
A little bit of a loaded question. But
are you referring to the running piece itself?
I was just like, I think a few people surprised themselves with what pacing they were able to hold in it. And again, in a vacuum, that's really good for sports specific application. Single workout shows up, like you have the energy system to go crush that. But there's still very serious implications if an athlete has eighth gear and first, second, third, fourth aren't so great.
I was going to say, is it a little bit of a loaded question because like it depends on the athlete a bit, like what, like you were kind of alluding to with their energy systems and how they approached it. And like, you know,
I mean, body size matters. Are we talking about running? Are we talking about
all know,
being able to sit on a seat?
We all know athletes that, you know, if it's that time domain on a rower, it's like, psh, big deal. And then you tell them that same time, it's on your feet. Oh, I can't fucking do that. Like, sure. So there are a lot of things that you can infer from that, but like, you know, I use the opportunity to have a piece like that to ask them like, all right, why did this go so well? And how can we like reverse engineer this for other things? Is it the time domain that you felt you were really good at? Was it the fact that it was on a machine that you really liked versus one you didn't like? Do you find that you've
maybe you've skipped your math sessions recently and that's why this is harder than it has been in the past. So it's like just a chance to check in with an athlete and go through the checklist you kind of already mentioned there and say, let's address each one of these points. And then if it didn't go well, like what is the box that hasn't been ticked, or what are the boxes that haven't been ticked recently that we need to make sure we do a better job of? Like, you know, you decided that you could fucking do a 5-minute jog around the track and then start your 500s and that wasn't good enough. Like there's a lot to be learned from that. So I just think of like when you have days like this and they go really well, tell me more about them so that we can like write a story of how that went so that you can kind of go back and read that story and say, all right, this is fucking coming up. And last time it was amazing for rowing. How am I going to make this work for running? So sort of a loaded question there, but like I try to talk them through. I say, talk me through that session. Tell me how that went. What things were good? Why did you feel like that? And then how can we create this, you know, outside of that little, you know, singular instance?
And one other prompt here, Hunter, that I can add for a bit more nuance or context is today is February 12th. If you're listening to this, the day that it comes out, build, run, fourth gear, 2 rounds, run 1,800 meters, rest 2 minutes. It's 2Ks for MFT athletes. You're going to find out something else about your energy systems in 2x1,800 versus 8x400. Like I, it's very intentional to go low end right after this in terms of build and be like, okay, can you now go run for longer than a mile at what would be potentially 45 seconds to a minute per mile slower than that and hold it and actually be able to repeat it?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you think about it as an athlete, it can be helpful to think about it in terms of like extreme on one end and extreme on the other. Like what is the, you know, what are the two bookends of that spectrum, which is kind of the intent of the gears matrix, the gear, you know, kind of using first gear through, is it ninth gear or eighth gear is the fastest?
Through
eight, having those bookends is really important so that you can fill in the gaps. But something somebody asked in Discord is like, how, like, should I, and I think we answered it on a podcast, like, should I be updating like my gears matrix? And it's like, that updating happens every single time you do a training piece, because part of learning about what those paces are is also understanding that, like, on any given day, say you do that, what gear was that piece, the 1800 by two?
Fourth
gear
that,
piece.
So that's the lowest anaerobic build gear, essentially, that we have in there.
Yeah, so, like, if I, like, that gear today is probably not going to feel the same as that same gear a week from now and on a different machine or on the same machine. So again, part of that goes back to like the feeling, but part of it goes to continuously updating and recognizing like what things are going to make this, you know, might make this faster or slower. A lot of it too for monostructural stuff to me goes back to desensitization. It's just like if I feel good about being on a machine doing this piece, but I feel really bad when it's on my own 2 feet, that's like, those aren't necessarily as much, there's a fitness component to it as well, but I would say it's more so has to do with the athlete's comfortability level on, you know, the various machines or the, you know, it might be an energy system thing, but if it's the same kind of gear, different machine or different approach, I think it's more of a desensitization thing than maybe a fitness thing.
One of my notes that I wrote last week to explore more that we talked about in the podcast was just the direct correlation between how long someone has a weakness and how impatient they are in relation to that. It's such a powerful concept. And I think that so many of these machines like have the Malcolm Gladwell thing just attached to them. If you put in your 10,000 hours on your feet or on a bike seat, or on a rower seat, or at the ski erg, things just change. And of course, the more you do something, you get better at it. But there's something about like this monostructural work is like the discomfort sets in when you know you're pacing properly. It's kind of just there almost immediately in a lot of senses. Like you're uncomfortable, your heart rate goes up, or you know you have localized muscle fatigue on something more like the biker or the ski erg. And, yeah, I just, there's really something powerful about like, shh, no more talkie, go joggy. Like,
I mean,
like,
at
please,
a certain,
just get
yeah,
to work.
At a certain point, once you know enough about yourself as an athlete, it's not a matter of like, whether this is going to be uncomfortable or comfortable. It's just going to be like, what type of discomfort is this? And am I adequately sensitized to that level of discomfort? A, you know, running slowly for 60 minutes is, some people might find that more comfortable than 100 meter sprint repeats, but it's just a different, it's just a different kind of discomfort. It's kind of funny whenever I was hiking, like doing a march or some sort, with a weight, there's never a point where it's just like, wow, nothing hurts. It's just which thing. It's kind of what Ted was saying. It's like nothing doesn't hurt. There's always one thing, and it might that one thing might only hurt a little bit compared to something else, but it's like, no, if my feet don't hurt, my back hurt. If my back feels fine, then my traps are really tight because the backpack on my, you know, is just bearing down. And it's just like, if it's not one thing, it's going to be the other. And it's just kind of a matter of getting comfortable with all of the various like types of discomfort that you're going to experience at the different paces that you're being asked to go. Obviously, you're going to have a personal preference as to which type of discomfort is most comfortable for you. But again, kind of downside of becoming a more experienced athlete is that, you know, there's no way to make it pleasant. It's like, how do I approach this correctly to make it the most effective, which is still going to be a certain level. There's still going to be a certain level of discomfort associated with that.
To me is a bit of a like weird roundabout sales pitch for meditation. Because what you're talking about, like people can get wrapped up in the annoyance of like a blister, or like I did a bunch of rucking when my knee was bothering me, but the weather was better and I wanted to just like add some intensity to a walk. And my traps hurt so bad the whole time, and my legs were fine. My lungs, everything else was fine the whole time. And I'm like, what the, this is like so uncomfortable. But if you've done enough of the like, that's your foot. Is your foot a part of your body? Like, are you your foot, or are you just in your face or your head? Like the Sam Harris stuff where he like talks you through all of that. And then you like separate it out and you're like, it's so weird that that someone's foot over there is hurting. But like, I actually don't feel any sort of like warning bells in my physiology going off other than, wow, that's kind of annoying that that foot thing is like painful,
hurting,
like that sort of thing.
Is so happening.
Hurting is happening. Like, whatever. Not a big deal. Like, I didn't get punched in the face or anything like that. Like, my brain's fine. Like, I'm good to go.
Because to catch it, I'll threaten you.
Fuck. I don't dare. Sherb, tell us about this Sprinterval making its way into Team Misfit, because we dance around a lot of these ideas because of the different worlds that we're in when it comes to the affiliate level, games level, hatchet level, the entire spectrum here could be beginner's class. But we do really like to dig into this idea of stimulus over basically everything. And that can apply in a lot of ways to all levels simultaneously. And I didn't know that Hunter brought the Sprinterval over to the template, but it sounds like he threw it in there and then you made it work in a way that was the fucking talk of the town that day.
Yeah, I mean, essentially we just tried to get athletes to
want to tell people
there.
The piece, Sherb, first so people have context.
Yeah, so it was
show them your piece.
3 rounds. 12 box jump overs on a taller than usual box for the affiliate. So, you know, our affiliate normal height is 24 inches for the men, 20 for the women. So this was 30/24. So you got to work a bit more to get those knees up. 6 touch and go cleaning jerks. RX was 155/105. And then a 12/8 calorie bike sprint with a 4 minute rest, which we stuck to here. I did write in the coach's notes that like, if you got a big class, you want to make, you know, a team of four and have them go 1, 2, 3, 4 through it and then go through it a second time, then a third time you could, but essentially work for roughly 2 minutes or less and then rest for 4 minutes.
And because, yeah, exactly. People are like, why so much rest? You'll learn. Don't you worry, you'll learn. Essentially, in that piece, we were looking for something that is less than 2 minutes per round in effort. And to make that accessible to everybody, that just means, you know, the box needs to be the right height, bar needs to be the right weight, and the bike just, sorry, it sucks. It's going to suck. So we were, you know, kind of telling athletes here, jump on something a little bit taller than you're used to, find the heaviest weight you think you can do six touch and go clean and jerks with, and we're going to make sure we get plenty of reps in so you figure that out, and then you're going to feel terrible, but try to bike as hard as you can. And, you know, it was a fun way to disguise the stimulus of essentially, like, I don't know, 3x30 cal bike in class. It had a very similar, like, terribleness to it. And this, the beauty of, like, tricking someone with, oh, you get the box jump and barbell before you bike, so it's not a bike sprint. It felt the same way. So, you know, I saw that piece, and, you know, we often talk in our meetings about, like, what is the line? Because if you go to an affiliate level athlete and you push them too far past that line, they're going to get cautious and play it safe. And it just doesn't give you the same kind of sprintable vibe that we would have for a competitor who just knows, like, sorry, this is going to suck. I'm just going to light my hair on fire and go regardless of how bad it's going to feel. So I think the workout really hit the mark in that regard. And, you know, everybody was saying this, like, the worst their legs felt in a really long time. So anytime, you know, you come into a class, whether it's like first thing in the morning, you're not coaching it, you just see a bunch of people laid out on the floor, like, having a bad time, or you walk in and you see Hunter on all fours in front of his bike, like, just like not having a good time, you know, it's a good workout. So I was pretty pleased with how that came.
You got to tell them, we finally hurt the unhurtable human.
Oh,
or at least with a Metcon.
Yeah. He's like, this is hard. I'm like, yeah, it's supposed to be fucking hard, Ryan. It's supposed to be hard.
A lot of the listeners know Ryan McKay, who will do a sprint piece in class with all of us. And we're all just like in a real bad place on the floor, rolling around. He holds a faster pace than you and then goes, I don't think I did it right. It wasn't very hard. And you're like, dude, right now is not the time to say that. And this is such a special
read
occasion.
The room, McKay. Fuck.
Yeah. Sherb walks into my office mid-class and goes, you got to come out here. And Ryan is draped over the arms of the air runner trying to walk. His face was so fucking red. Like,
yeah,
so
he was
red.
Real sad.
He disappeared like, after the workout. At one point, like, almost like hallucinating a little bit, because he was talking shit to, like, no one. Like, I couldn't tell if he was talking to himself, if he was talking to me.
His ears were ringing.
The workout. James was standing. It was very
His
odd.
Ear was ringing.
He was. Oh, right. Yeah. So, yeah, any time something like that elicits that type of response, I feel like it's fucking newsworthy for the podcast, because it's cool when something like that works all the way across. It's like, obviously the dose is so important when it comes to changing it for a specific athlete, but I was glad to see it make its way in, like when we do something like a cube test in class, because obviously it's just, you know, it's 16 minutes of shitty work, so that's always a good time.
I'd like to see someone go sub 1 minute for all three rounds. Ryan got 2 out of 3. He failed on the third one. I think Tia was close, but missed it by just a little bit as well. But there was a good battle back and forth between those two on the top time of the day there. But sub 1 minute for all three rounds would be
I mean, that's
got to
be
score.
A box jump over thing, right? And then how far away the implements are spaced from each other?
A little bit of that, but also Ryan could have transitioned harder. That's the one thing I yelled at him for after round one. I'm like, you can go faster if you move faster between the implements. Like, they weren't that far apart, but, like, you know, little bit of a couple of steps over there, take a second.
I feel like that's like
bar.
A 50-second round for Austin.
I think so, but I don't think or Austin's less. Doing that three times. Prove it. Do it, Austin.
Probably depends on other rebounding box jumps or not, which we typically don't tell.
I told everybody do what the fuck you wanted. And that workout, just because, like, stepping down from 30 inches is pretty sure. hard.
Yeah. That was the one thing that some members were discouraged about. They're like, I'm on my, like, second box jump and people are doing clean and jerks. It's like, that is the cadence of that movement is so different athlete to athlete. And also when you go slower, that's a movement cost one right there. People that are going slower are doing a lot more work. So you're, like, stopping, restarting. You're not using the stretch reflex. You're probably jumping higher. Like, that is a very high movement cost when you're taking extra time on that movement. It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah. No, it was fun to watch. Sucked. I mean, top to bottom, it made people hurt. So, you know, it did what it was supposed to do.
That's Ted, I'm going to say something. You tell me if I made it up or not.
Okay.
If you head to themisfitpodcast.com in the bottom right corner, there's a little microphone. And if you click that, you can leave us a voicemail for the podcast.
You said it right. TheMisfitPodcast.com.
TheMisfitPodcast.com. When I put it on my vertical screen, the icon disappears. So I was confused when I was trying to find the instructions.
Interesting.
When I put it on this one, honestly, the way that I have this monitor set up, almost no website works on it. Right. Like a lot of things disappear. Because I make it like 100 feet tall, monitor. 2 inches wide. Yeah, it's great. It's so I can read your fucking 9 mile long cells, Sherb. You and Gabe, 14, size 14 font. So we have a voicemail this week from someone who listened to the podcast that just dropped a few days ago from when we're recording.
Yes.
In reference to the RPE percentage conversation.
Hey guys, my name is Andrew Boyce. I'm a coach here over in Michigan. And I liked your RPE versus percentages discussion. Some dialogue I would add on to that is using RPE in conjunction with reps in reserve. I use RPE a lot in training for CrossFit or, you know, personal training. But I use it as a guidepost to cap intensity, whether to push it. So you give them an RPE 9. Maybe if I want to hold intensity off, I would say, hey, cap this at an RPE 8 or 7 or 8, whatever that is. The reps in reserve, if you guys don't know, that's, you know, RPE 8, you have 2 reps in reserve, RPE 9, you have 1, and that can extend across all rep schemes. Obviously the closer you get to a, single, the more accurate that gets. There's a lot of discussion to have on this, and I'd love to chat with you guys further. All right. Peace. Hey guys.
So thanks for the voicemail. My mind goes to coaching context. You guys can take it in another direction if you want. It is so important that you learn to have, we talked about Hunter's Inspector Gadget responses that he can put in his sheet. His buzzsaw comes out and cuts the screen in half. You need to have your Inspector Gadget essentially tools of vocabulary when you're a coach at all these different levels and understand when to use what with what athlete. Now, in a lot of the context that I have personally, and then if you have for doing the personal training that you referenced, you get to work with the same person on a regular basis. And then you can really find out, like, percentage work is great for them. Like, hey, I want you to work up to a heavy set of 4 today. Accessory work can be like, that's typically where I would use reps in reserve. I would say, hey, we're going to do whatever, 6 drop sets of dumbbell bench press. And I want you to leave maybe none on the table or 2 on the table or 1 on the table, that sort of thing. So what I think coaches need to be really careful of is the, back to using the midwit meme of like, this is the way that I communicate to you, and you're wrong if you don't understand it and don't really sort of take it in. So that's where my mind goes in a lot of this, is having these different tools to go in and talk to athletes and figure out which ones work. And you guys can probably speak a lot better to like what works in an affiliate sense, because some of the statements that you make in front of the whiteboard need to be a catch-all and kind of far-ranging, because you're not going to go to each person standing there and explain what you're trying to say. And I know that you guys do that when you're talking through like the whiteboard briefing of, it's this many reps at this percent, this is what it should feel like, that sort of thing. So definitely familiar with the funny thing is the reps in reserve I use for myself more often than I would use in a CrossFit sense. Like, I do a significant amount of accessory work to keep my back and my joints healthy, and I just know that when I take myself to like using the Misfit sets for an example, like, or doing the 6x10s, like when I take myself pretty close to that line, that's when linear progression I think works a little bit better for me. So using reps in reserve helps me if I'm concerned with, I want to use 40-pound dumbbells, and then I want to use 45-pound dumbbells, and then I want to use 50s, that sort of thing.
For me, yeah, I think I knew it.
Yeah. Jinx.
I was trying to wait too.
What jumps out is just the amount of knowledge both the athlete and the coach need to have of each other to make that system work really well. And we all work with athletes that tell you they can't do fucking one more, and then they do more in the second set. It's like, that's not how that's supposed to fucking work. or like literally like, oh, I'm going to do smooth sets of handstand pushups. I decided I was going to do 10, 10, 10, 10. And in my last set, I did 40. It's like, what the fuck is that? That's no. So you have to say something like, hey, your max set shouldn't be more than double what you did for your smooth set. So you have to start explaining more. So like, I think it's a fine jumping off point to help someone understand kind of the just broad context of what you're looking for. But I just think I just don't love it because I do think it's too subjective and it leaves development and potential off the table because there's just, you have to know that person so well and you have
well,
to work
you could
with
write
them
their so story busy. For them before they get to write it themselves.
Oh, good. I'm at 10. Stop. Good. I'm good.
And a lot of these instances and man, there's just some athletes that have that fucking spirit in them and it's so fun to watch the like the 10 did look hard and then the 40, you're like, I don't know what's happening. How the fuck do they keep doing reps? So yeah, that's, I think, I don't know. I mean, basically what we're saying is like, there isn't an answer to this question and that's why we need to have the conversations about separate, different ways to communicate with different athletes. That's like where my mind goes in a lot of it.
A little bit of people are like, hey, give us a score for this workout. It reminds me a lot of that. Like when we write a Metcon, it's fucking 15 minute AMRAP of X, Y, and Z. It's like, what's a good score? Like one, we don't want to set a bar that's so far away from somebody that they're like, fuck, I should just quit, you know, sell my house and move away. And we also don't want to create a score that's so easy to attain. Like, I'm the fucking best in the world. I should just
do not
my math,
cap
not
outliers.
Lifting.
Do not cap those outliers. Those are the people that progress the sport that show us what we can do. Like, you need those people for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since we got that question, but it's bound to come back around again. And it's for that reason. It's like, here's what you're looking to feel like. Here's how I want you to approach it. Fucking have fun. Let's see what happens. And then when some rando in the community does two more rounds than everybody else, and everyone's like, how the fuck did that happen? And a dialogue is created, and we figure out, oh, they did this thing, that thing, and the other thing, or they're really good at this, they're really good at that. You need to work on this, you need to work on that. There's a lot of information that can be gained community wide when someone sets the new standard. It's the 225 snatch bar we've talked about in the past, where like one person did it, and then fucking 90% of the males in the field could do it.
Dude, they did the 100-pound dumbbell snatch at regionals that year, and everyone had to go find one, first of all, like driving around trying to find that, and no one could lift that damn thing off the ground. And regionals was a few weeks later, and everyone manhandled that dumbbell. Just all it takes is some meathead walk up to it and just muscle snatch it that doesn't even compete, and then the competitor's like, fuck you, I'm doing two, even though my PR's zero. Like,
we watched that happen in the athlete area for the sandbag clean, the games.
Oh, yeah.
The one
fuck
rep
yeah.
Max sandbag clean. How game many athletes did we watch fucking pick up a 240-pound sandbag and they're just like, well, you're done. Like, see ya. That's a 40th place finish for you. And then all of a sudden, every single person is picking up the 270-pound bag or whatever. And it was like, yeah, I think the context and who you're commute. So when the voicemail was left, you said, I use this for CrossFit training. I don't know if that was like as a coach to the masses or for your own personal training. And then you said personal training. I think that it has, like Sherb said, it has, or I don't remember which one of you said it, but like if it's a one-on-one situation where you and the athlete have like an understood language between the two of you and an expectation of what that actually means, then like go for it. I think that's just a different way. Like you could say like percentage work is better. You could say RPE and reps and reserve is better. As long as both people are reading off the same sheet of music and they're executing in the way that it's intended, whatever. When it comes to like an affiliate, I think I see a much higher probability of an athlete leaving too much on the table versus accidentally overextending themselves and going like, oh, coach said an RPE of 7 and I accidentally did 9. And it's like, and if that were to happen, which is less likely than, oh, I went at 7, but, or he said 7, but it was probably more of a 6 in hindsight. And it's like, you do that accidentally over the course of months and years, and you're capping that athlete in what they are, one, capable of, and two, like their own, what they can actually do as a result of what they think they can do. And I think it's just like for the newer athlete, it's like they don't fucking know what that is. Like me personally, if you tell me to do a set of set of like a max rep set of back squats and leave three reps in the tank. You're going to say, do an RPE of 7, leave three reps in reserve. Like, I've been doing CrossFit for a hot minute, and I might not be able to say like, yeah, I would have definitely failed the fourth rep if I could get really close. I could leave one rep in reserve. I know what that feels like. It means that I barely stood up the rep that I just did, and there's no fucking way I'm getting out of the bottom of the squat in this next one. Two reps might be like, there's still a line there. Maybe I could have done two, maybe I could have done three. And beyond that, and the listener acknowledged this, like beyond that, it's kind of a crapshoot. But for me, it's like, you tell an affiliate athlete who comes to the gym 3 to 5 times a week to do a max rep set, but leave three reps in reserve, that person has no fucking idea what you're talking about. They don't know what you're talking about, and there's almost no way that they actually execute that correctly. And like it, and even if they do, it's like, yeah, I feel like I nailed that 7 out of 10. I definitely had three reps in reserve. I don't know how beneficial that is for the recreational CrossFitter. Certainly, we talk a lot about like intensity spread out over, you know, we obviously can't ask athletes to bash their head into the wall every single day. But again, for the general population, recreational 3 to 5 times a week CrossFitter, like, and maybe as the person, that's the only physical activity they do, like, I'm a little bit more okay with telling that person to beat their head into the wall, go to failure, go within a rep of failure, whatever that means. And again, like having that intimate knowledge of yourself as an athlete, and you also have to have an experience level that makes that make sense. I'm not going to tell a beginner to leave three reps in the tank because the beginner doesn't know what that means. They don't know how much they're supposed to be lifting. I'm going to say, hey, do a 7 out of 10 RPE. They don't know what 7 out of 10 is because they don't know what 2 is. They don't know what 5 is, and they don't yet have the physical capacity to go at 10. Like we see athletes all the time who, it's like on bike sprint day, the people who are not beat up by bike sprint day are the athletes who are either so new or so unfit that they can't actually put the effort in to get the stimulus that we're after. And like, that's fine. That's just kind of part of the journey for that athlete as they move along. But I think it's at the reps in reserve thing adds a second layer of subjectivity that again requires the athlete and the coach to have intimate knowledge of themselves and of each other, understand the mutual language that is being spoken, and then the athlete has the ability to actually execute correctly in order to get like what we're after. And I think part of the bias here is that I've never used the system before, so I'm obviously going to say like, I'm not familiar with this, I don't know how it's working, and I can pick out 12 things that are wrong with it. And for someone else, it might work perfectly for them, but for me, it's a little bit too gray and a little bit too subjective. And when we're talking about a certain population of athlete, I'm better off having a one-on-one conversation with that person, or, you know, a little bit broader kind of guidance for that person.
Yeah, I can give a little bit of context for when someone could use it at that level. So basically, one of the things that Hunter referenced is like the movements he was talking about, the muscle engagement and the muscle fatigue is spread out to multiple muscle groups, different parts of the body. So you think about a back squat and what's being engaged, and then the idea of how much your nervous system is involved in the lift like that. If we go on the opposite end of the spectrum, and we have a movement that has very localized muscle fatigue and very low CNS demand, it can be really helpful to use a tool like reps in reserve if we're doing a day at the affiliate where it's like,
yeah, that's
like
true.
We're doing the pull-ups and the push-ups, we're doing strict press, we're doing strict handstand push-ups. And the more dynamic, again, that it is, the less that this comes into play. But it can be really helpful to like the research is there on the 6x10 rest 2 minutes that we use in a lot of instances. And to get through that properly, you kind of start to get a really good idea of like how many reps you have in reserve throughout the whole thing. Like you want to start with like 5 reps in reserve, but when you get done, it should be, if you did it right, between like 0 and 2, like that sort of thing. So it can be really helpful to tell people, hey, like your legs aren't here to save you. Your effort isn't here to save you. You're going to go do that next round of strict pull-ups and you're going to have nothing left. So let's make sure that we dial it back and we leave a few on the table so that we can go back to that. So I would say if someone was like, hey, how could I use this as an affiliate coach? That would be a place where you could go to people and say, hey, there's this thing, reps in reserve. If we get super close to the 0, 1, and 2 range, then we are getting stronger. But if we overshoot it and we can't do shit the whole workout, then it's not so great.
Yeah. To counter that, that relies on the athlete knowing what that is, like knowing what that line is. And if I say, hey, I want you to make sure, like, don't go to fail. What I'll tell athletes, like a strict handstand pushup is maybe a good example, or like very localized muscle fatigue. Once they're gone, they're gone. It's like, hey, I want you to, we've got 5 sets here. Don't go to failure on the first one. And I want your 5th set to be within like 2 or 3 reps of your first set. And a lot of times that gives people a better guidepost. But again, like level of athlete matters, experience level of that athlete matters. How like, Does the athlete know what their max set of strict handstand pushups is in that example? And you walk into the affiliate, I'd be willing to bet that not many do.
You would be asking them to think this through while they're moving.
Sure.
Which is another element.
Yeah, and you're asking like, yeah, you're on the ring, you're doing muscle ups. Like, hey, I want you to come down 2 reps before failure. It's like, am I like fucking doing the calculus as I'm in my arch position? And then it's like, okay, there's the 3. Dip. It's like, left. Now I got, yep, that was a, I got 2.1 more of these reps, like, okay, into the backswing, like, where do I feel? Like, oh no, my grip kind of hurts. Like, am I done? I think we're beating the dead horse here. The other, I don't know if this is like how far this conversation goes into like the Metcon realm, but I think that's like also a place where it's like, hey, athlete, this is a 15-minute AMRAP. I want you to do a 6 RPE 6. It's like, what? Like
the more complex this shit gets thrown in the trash as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, what is that? It's like, okay, well, 21 thrusters to start off Fran for an affiliate athlete could be an RPE of fucking 10. Is the whole workout now a 10? I think when we can all probably agree, when you get into Metcons, it's like that system's garbage. But there's also
use it to moderate intensity. Like that would be place that you could use it. You could tell an athlete, like, you know, like, let's talk through what RPE 7 feels like for you. Like when you're there, like, what is that for you on a rower, this or that? Like, we're practicing today. I don't want you to leave that realm. Like, you could put a limiter on certain things. But yeah, no, if you've got a moving target RPE throughout an entire CrossFit workout and you're asking yourself in the moment where you're supposed to be, you're going to be all over the place. Obviously.
Right. And it's going to vary movement to movement.
Subjective on a subjective scale.
Yeah.
The problem that, and again, this is, as far as we know, adopted from the endurance community in a lot of ways, where it's a lot easier to ask an athlete to give a certain level of effort in something that is single modality for
sustained,
a certain period of time.
Like,
exactly. You go in and do that. The problem that a lot of programs are trying to solve, and it's like a valiant effort and we're all chasing the same thing, is what happens when you program the same percentage for people with different muscle fiber types and different recovery levels? Like, it's not 80% is not 80% for everybody. People are using old maxes, new maxes. So the system that we use more often is also imperfect. So that's basically what people are chasing.
For sure.
But I think the downsides that are attached to it are pretty large, unless, again, the athlete, like, you got to be talking about the kind of athlete that's like putting their sets and reps into spreadsheets every day and writing notes about every individual set and that sort of thing. And those people do exist, but not so often.
I think the base problem I have with RPE is that at the foundation, like where you are basing that the exertion off of is not defined. It's like, so if you say 80%, like that is a fixed number, like 80% of your one rep max is fixed. And 8 out of 10 RPE is not fixed. Now, you can debate whether they're the exact same thing or not, but if you're adjusting from a known point, an 80%, like you have something to go back to. You have kind of that foundation to go back to.
Rather
to
than
say,
saying
okay,
make it feel like 80%, just put 80% on the bar and then adjust from there.
Yeah, and then see what that feels yeah. like. You know, it's like you almost build the RPE off of like 80%, for example. Sure. With RPE, yep. it's like, do your back squat sets at an 8 out of 10 RPE. It's like, I don't know what that means, and it's different from day to day. And if I want to improve an RPE of a week ago, what it like is going to be different than an RPE today. It is just there's no consistency. There's no place to branch off of without that initial point being set kind of in the ground.
True. Final thoughts, gents. We've been meandering, so I'll
pee
start.
Pee or poop.
Sorry. Thank you for bringing us full circle. My final thoughts will just be shouting out Shane, who asked the question. You're narrowing in, you're asking the right questions. You're narrowing in on things. And I think it's super important to put those types of things out into the universe so that we can give you, like I wrote them down, like we give you essentially 5 different reasons why this could be happening. And with your context, we feel like we've got a pretty good idea of where that's at, but it is also possible, that there's a sliver of the other things that are also in there. So, it would just be a nudge to other athletes to start asking the right questions about your training and where certain things are at. Because a lot of times, if you stop asking the questions, you know, are the super easy ones to answer, kind of the fluff ones, and you like narrow in on what's going on, you might have your answer staring right back at you. It might be like, oh, I'm avoiding this thing and this is kind of easy. Why do I suck at this movement? How often do I do it? How hard am I trying? Have I, you know, gone out and got advice on how to do better at it? That sort of thing. So we're getting to that point in the year where asking the right questions is incredibly important, because the variable training system where you're picking some of your pieces is going to be useless if you're asking the wrong questions.
I'll talk to the opposite end of the spectrum, which is the maybe less experienced, the not 45th in the world athlete. We spent time talking to, it was Shane, you said? Shane was the master who asked the initial question. Talked to him about, this is an athlete who has a lot of his picture, so to speak, filled in, his whether it's his spreadsheet gears matrix or his general athlete IQ, you know, chart, graphic, whatever it is, a lot of that is filled in, and there's a small gap that when sealed up is going to move the needle for him. And by move the needle for him, we're talking about a handful of places in an online competition that will take him to the next level. Most of you listening are not that athlete. Learning how to set yourself on fire and then kind of adjust from there is far more valuable, in my opinion, than becoming a master pacer in CrossFit workouts. You will become better at pacing by learning what not to do within the context of going too hard. And for the affiliate athletes, affiliate coaches out there, like there are not that many athletes at the affiliate level who are going to like, who it would be detrimental to say, yeah, I just want you to go really hard, see what happens. I don't want you to overpace this. Sometimes we get wrapped up in the nuance of communicating the exact right pace to get the exact right score. But for a lot of people, we're not chasing the score. And even for competitive athletes, you're not chasing a score. You're chasing a stimulus. And then the 3 times a year, 24.1, 2, and 3, then you can apply your, you know, pull out the chemistry set, put on the goggles and be like, what's the exact right pace for this workout? Do I do you know, 15 and change 6 for my pull-ups, or do I do change plates instead of high temps? Do I wear my fucking, do I put my weightlifting shoes over my shoulder so I can change them really quickly from this thing to another?
Fuck. The other, if you're doing barbell gymnastics.
Yeah, the other 99% of the year doesn't fucking matter, and you're better off learning where your upper end maximum limit is and then filling in the gaps underneath that versus being the more kind of cautious athlete and gradually figuring out, like, it's like, oh, I could go faster. I can go faster. You're just leaving too much fitness on the table to, and you might just not have the nearly enough experience to justify, like, that kind of going the bottom to top versus top to bottom.
You could get a pair of lifters that's just big enough to put your regular shoe into, so you don't have to change your shoes. You just
put
them
on. That's a
good
idea. I've never seen that. That would be the...
look like an Osiris?
The natural iteration, yeah. Gonna quick shed this layer of shoes.
What if Osiris came out with fucking lifters that you could put your shoes inside of? I'm gonna
Bro, I saw a picture of
the problem is somebody's gonna
body with those on. He was wearing those fucking Osiris shoes like we all like had Doug in like 8th grade. Dude, his fucking legs matched the shoes. It made no sense. You know, usually like you have these tiny little dainty ankles coming out of those giant shoes. His lower leg matched the shoe.
And dummy
it
thick?
It confused my brain because I know what Mahdi looks like now. He doesn't look like that. It was fucking creeping me out. Final thoughts, since you guys have already kind of covered both ends of that. Super Bowl prediction. What is the score? I know who you predicted to win. What is the score? I can go first or I can go last. Doesn't matter to me.
Let me see what I've bet.
I'm going to go 27 Chiefs, 21 49ers.
Chiefs with 31. 49ers, 22.
31?
31 to 22.
That's like one of those uncommon scores that you were waiting to see the
score. How do you get 31?
Just roll it around in your noggin there.
Four touchdowns and a field goal.
Three eighths and a four touchdown. Okay, fair enough. That's not as stupid as I thought it was.
Yes, it is.
No, it was a stupid question. You're right.
22.
You're up. 22.
No. We'll go
3-2.
24-17.
Fuck.
Ooh.
People keep saying... Yeah, that's where my head was at.
I don't even do football, guys. Sports. Come on now.
Wow, you can add sevens and threes. Congratulations.
How do you get 31? Though?
I couldn't 3 seconds ago, but I can now.
How do you get seven,
linear,
eight,
I did 31. Linear progression on that.
Yeah. 24-20. I'll give the 49ers a little bit more credit. If they give McCaffrey the ball, we can get a fucking game. If they get cute and let the fucking 900th pick in the NFL draft throw it too much, it's not going to go so well.
Bro, he put the team on his back.
We'll see. We'll see about that.
Get crushed.
Someone's going to sound... Well, no, we all picked the Chiefs. So if the 49ers lose, we're just a team full of losers here. 49ers win.
Niners, what did I say? Niners ain't... I know what you meant. Niners ain't
I didn't specify who wins, so I get...
They all win.
Yeah, Hunter just said numbers.
I hope everyone loses. How about that?
I'm okay with
they all lose. Did we do it?
We did it.
Cheer.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of the Misfit Podcast, and thank you to our show sponsors, sharpentheaxco.com. Use your favorite athlete code. You save 10%. They get 10%. Properfuel.co. Use the code word Misfit. Misfitathletics.com for your individual programming needs. Teammisfit.com for your affiliate programming needs. I'll see you next week.